Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening from Fort Lauderdale. This is Nate Klarfeld with Stonewall Live, the best of gay and lesbian book, film, and media talk on Blog Talk Radio. Tonight, my guest is David Pratt, author of Bob the Book and My Movie. David, say hello.
Hello.
Okay.
Hello, Fort Lauderdale.
Hey, it's fun. It's hot and it's fun. You know, it's like the only place I want to live right now. Listen, Bob the Book, your novel, won the 2011 Lambda Literary Award for Best Gay Fiction. It's a book. We chatted a little bit online today.
It actually won for Best Debut.
Oh, Best Debut. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Okay. I was giving you better, you know, better props there. But anyway, it is the best book I've read in a long time. And we talked about what was my first question going to be, and you brought it up, and it said, you wrote a book about what?
It's a book about a gay book. You know, when I first came out into the gay literary world, I went to, I used to go to the old Outright Conference in Boston and, you know, some other gay literary symposia, and someone would always start to talk about gay books, and then someone else would interrupt and say, well, what exactly do we mean by a gay book? The issue being, you know, there are things like Moby Dick and Death in Venice and so forth that have these overtones and undertones, but, you know, what's really classified as a gay book? And then to get a laugh, someone else would say, well, a gay book is a book attracted to other books of the same gender, ha ha. And so I was actually, during a summer break in my MFA many years ago, a group of us had pledged to write something every single day over the summer and post it online. And by July, this just got so burdensome to me. The whole literary thing felt so burdensome. I was really a desperate man looking for an idea. And since I thought, well, you know, these things are very disposable. We just write something every day. And, you know, if it doesn't fly, then we write something else the next day. So I wrote the first chapter of Bob the Book because I thought, you know, here is a circumstance just ridiculous enough for this ridiculous idea, and I have to write something today.
Mm-hmm.
And then two of my classmates sent me this wonderful feedback. They loved it. They wanted more. And so after taking a few days to think about where it would go next, I wrote chapter two and so forth. And so that is how this pretty crazy idea actually turned into a book.
Great. Let me tune in the listeners a little bit about the book, and we'll talk more. It's a gay book for sale. Bob the Book is a gay book for sale in a Greenwich Village bookstore, where he falls in love with another book, Moishe. Now, the name of the book and Bob are two different books. Bob is actually a anthology about male erotica. And Moishe is a book about gay Orthodox Jews. And they get separated, these young lovers. They get, you know, they're right next to each other, and so they huggle and snuggle and stuff like that. So you treat them like humans. They talk about themselves. They get catty with other books. They get separated. They meet again. They get separated again. Along the way, they go to, you know, everywhere from used book bins to laying on the floor to witnessing, you know, gay violence, all sorts of things. Did you just write this from just as it went, or did you have a regular plot that this was going to happen?
I started off writing it as it went. I was in this sort of, you know, write it on the fly, low pressure kind of atmosphere, never thinking this would come to anything. So I just sort of tossed anything out there that I could to keep it going. At a certain point, about halfway through, I realized, you know, this does have to come together somehow. And in fact, there's a certain point in the book where you can start to see the author sort of juggling all the balls.
Right.
In the air.
Yeah.
Which becomes part of the fun of it. You know, am I going to get all the plot strands together in the end? I never thought much farther ahead than maybe the next chapter until I got toward the end. I think out of the 15 chapters, 12 is quite long, I think. And that was where I started to think, okay, I've got to have a vision for how this ends now.
Okay.
And So there was some planning toward the end, but yeah, lots of plot, lots of coincidences. It's kind of fun that way.
For a book, Bob got around.
Bob does get around.
Bob gets around. Yeah. And his friends do.
Thanks largely to Angela,
right,
who is a copy of Mansfield Park by Jane Austen. Angela teaches Bob and some of his friends that they can influence human buyers, potential buyers, by kind of working on their thoughts, by sort of beaming positive thoughts to them. So the books are kind of able to get themselves bought and lent, and thus move around, which is, I needed something, so came up with Angela. And maybe books really can do that. I wouldn't be surprised.
I think they do. I mean, I think this book makes you think about your own book collection and, you know, what's going on with books right now. And I find it amazing. I find it really funny because that you chose Jane Austen for Angela as the spark that said that taught them how to fly or taught them how to talk or taught them how to emote or whatever. It's because I love Jane Austen. I'm one of those other gay men that love Jane Austen. But surprise. but do you talk to your books? Because I talk to my books sometimes. I do. I walk by and talk to them.
I myself have been more sensitized to my books after having written this, and one of the unfortunate byproducts of entering the gay literary world is you suddenly have lots and lots of books around, and you can't eat them all.
Yeah.
You need to read books by friends, books by people you want to be friends, books you're just plain interested in that have won awards, that are being published by the same publisher as you. So there are all these books coming through suddenly. And you just can't hang on to them all. So I try to be very sensitive about donating them or giving them to people who I know will take good care of them.
Right.
Talking to them, not so much, but certainly caring about their fate.
That's a good thing. That's great. And then I'm going to give my plug from the Stonewall National Museum and Archives, which is America's largest gay and lesbian lending library with 28,000 books. Most of them were donated by people who moved to Florida and found that apartments were even smaller than New York.
Impossible.
Well, we don't have closets. They left them out in a lot of these buildings. They're pretty small. It's okay. But anyway, so we ended up with a lot of donations, and that's how we catalog, and we do buy books. But many of them are donated, and we keep a second and third copies off storage. Okay, there's my plug. And listen, we have a call-in number for anyone that wants to talk to either me or David. It's 805-830-8355. Okay, I want to talk about your book, My Movie, which is a collection of short stories. My Movie is 14 short stories?
Yes.
My notes were right. Okay, good. So I have 14 short stories. They range in everything from beautiful metaphors to, can I say soft porn?
Definitely like erotic, weird, surreal, twisted.
Okay, I said soft. But yeah, okay, you say that. Well, you've been published in Fresh Men, I think. Is that right?
In Don Wisey's series Fresh Men,
right?
Literary fiction. It's distinct from the magazine that's called Fresh Men.
I didn't think the magazine. I mean Fresh Men. I meant the literary. You've been in Fresh Men and you've been in many other literary magazines. I just brought that one up because they do range in many ways. And how difficult is it to sell a book of any kind of short stories, let alone gay short stories?
It is not easy. It's not easy. In addition, these stories, they're quite different. As you mentioned, the range of when they were written is very great, and the range of kinds of things. Some are humorous, some are lyrical. Many of them, you know, in spite of a few dark times, Bob is pretty much a kind of bright, fun book. It moves along. This time of year, I recommend people take Bob to the beach.
Right.
My movie is kind of like a different vacation than the beach.
Right.
I'm one of those people who, when I hit London, I want to take the Jack the Ripper tour.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I want to see catacombs and
right.
dungeons and cemeteries and things like that. And, you know, I
wow.
like the beach too. But
right.
My movie is sort of a tour of the catacombs of the mind, of the,
uh-huh.
the gay male mind.
Okay.
In addition to the action that's actually happening, which can involve, you know, things like cruising and pickups and dates, there's how the characters are thinking about it and their anxieties and their fantasies. The title story, my movie, is actually about a young man who copes with his feelings by turning everything into a plot for a movie
mm-hmm.
that he might create.
Right.
So he will interrupt what's going on, the desires he's feeling or the things he's doing, say, I star in a movie where such and such happens, and it can be something
uh-huh.
very violent or sexual or strange. He fantasizes that on the island where he and his family are vacationing, there's this movie theater and that he's completely in charge of.
Mm-hmm.
He makes up the movies and decides when they run. And so so it's kind of a dark and... I don't quite say fantastical. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's not fantasy, but so that adds to what's been a little difficult about selling it because you know the stories aren't linked. They aren't all on one theme.
Right.
They really represent a range of genres
right.
I've tried, a range of ways I've thought about being queer,
right.
All that.
But that book,
they've gone over very well in readings though, and have some very good reviews.
Uh-huh. Well, I read that story, and the way I read it was that this was a young man who, you know, being gay, and his way of coping with being gay was to take, he felt out of control, and to gain the control, he was the one in charge of the movie theater. That was, he
yeah.
was in charge of his life. It was like an, you know, instead of having an Oprah moment, watching a lot of Oprah, he... to get control of his life, he just made up that he controlled his life through this movie or theater, and then of course in starring in this movie, which we all star in our own movies anyway. And I love the book, the one about the young man writing in code. That was wonderful. That really, I felt that one. I don't know why personally.
I'm glad you did.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's one that it doesn't get mentioned as much as some of the others, I think, because that one does kind of spook people a little bit.
I agree. I think anyone that's had what that secret locked inside of you that you know that someday you're going to have to scream out, but right now you know you don't want anyone to find out, and the code is the perfect. Metaphor
yeah.
for that. Yeah, so I loved it. Well, you know, in reading my movie, I really thought that it's at some times that really you weren't talking about gay people, even though there's a gay theme that runs through them. That's probably the only really link through all of them. What it was more like an American snapshot, that different parts of Americana in a certain period of time. I felt it was more American, an American group of short stories. Yeah, because you do capture the American spirit. I mean, it's like you're talking about, you know, camp counselors and movie theaters and vacations and, you know,
the Tom.
Yeah. So yeah, there's
and
a lot
of course,
go ahead.
There's a lot about AIDS and its impact on, for example, the Fire Island culture.
Right.
And the closing piece, which is called The Snow Queen, which
uh-huh.
I wrote many years ago, has been waiting a long time for a home. The setting is pure Americana. It's a
right.
small New England town in the late 1960s,
mm-hmm.
really before what we think of as the 1960s hit in any way. So it's really
right.
it's really almost 50s
uh-huh.
in its sensibility. But in the middle of this, you have this young boy who... you know, we assume that he is going to become gay, but all he knows is he feels like there's something wrong with him. He's not like others. He feels weak. He feels threatened.
Mm-hmm.
And he reaches out and becomes friends with a woman at his church who,
mm-hmm.
again, all he knows about her is he's comfortable with her and somehow her oddities match up with his own.
Mm-hmm.
We adults reading it see that she is probably a lesbian.
Mm-hmm.
And so all this and the anxieties around it and the hiding that they have to do and the things that they can't talk about all are couched in this very middle American setting, because that's what I came from. I came from a small New England town where everything was always just fine and just normal and just kind of suffocating in its fineness and its normalness. Also, the story that is called Not Pretty is sort of like that. You have this rather typical, idyllic New England shore summer with people sailing and, you know, doing whatever, going to the beach. In the middle of it is a young man who's trying to earn money for college, who is all fucked up in the head, if you'll pardon my saying. We maybe have, need the 7 second delay there.
No, we can say anything we want. We can say anything
He's all messed up about money, about sex, about food, and the three sort of intertwine and make for this very torturous summer for him in the middle of this idyllic environment. And that was also something I knew. You know, every year we went to Maine for vacation or went to Cape Cod, and it was supposed to be very beautiful and a very nice time, and the family was together and the water was beautiful, and yet, you know, I was having body issues and sexuality issues, and I was looking at the wrong people on the beach and, you know, wishing I could be different. So it was this kind of tortured thing. And that story actually came, it was another inspiration. The real trigger for that story was seeing a young man, you know, later on when I was in my 30s, I was on the Cape visiting my mother, and I saw a young man there, and he sold me a bus ticket, who just looked so unhappy. It was just engraved in his face, and he was only about 18 or 19. And I thought, I have to make him the hero of a story. And the story Not Pretty.
Oh, that's great. And you know, yes, there is a gay element to what you just said, but I think a lot of just young men, young teen coming of age, everyone has body issues and sexuality issues. You know, am I too geeky? Am I too strong? Does she like me? You know, am I getting caught looking too long? Of course, in the gay world, that's magnified 10 million gazillion times, unfortunately. We both call me Ant, the cynical old man here. it's true, but that we're cynical old men, not that it's that true. So we talked a little bit about how hard it was to get something published, and I always talk about this with authors because many people who are listening have contacted me about how to publish, how to do this, how to do that. And there is a huge tsunami going through the publishing industry right now with, of course, electronic readers. I don't have Bob as a book. I have Bob the book on my Kindle as I have my movie on the Kindle, on my partner and I's shared Kindle, which is even an odd thing. Sharing a Kindle with a partner is kind of sharing an account with a Kindle is an interesting thing. You get to see what he's reading and kind of fun stuff. But actually, how has that changed your world in literature?
Let's see. As a writer, I haven't really been in a position yet where I have. I think the most. The most powerful decision or most difficult decision, whatever, would be if you were going to decide whether to go with something as exclusively as an e-book or not.
Right.
Because someone of my age, of my generation, to have something published solely as an e-book would feel perhaps funny, like it's not really being published.
Correct.
However, so far, with both Bob, the book, and my movie, I can still feel like the paperback is the main event. The real book is the main event, because you know, it all, in both cases, the ebook and the real book came out simultaneously.
Uh-huh.
In both cases, the paperback has outsold the ebook.
Uh-huh.
So the ebook feels like this adjunct that is a nice thing to have, but I've never had to make the decision or have a publisher say to me, you know, I want to bring this out just as an ebook. Now, how will I feel about that? Will I feel like it's not really being published?
Right.
As a reader, I pretty much only purchase ebooks if it's for reference, if it's something I wouldn't ordinarily buy, but I just want to give it a quick read because I want to know something about the author because I'm going to meet them at something.
Uh-huh.
If I'm reviewing, and don't really have a great interest in the book beyond reviewing it.
Mm-hmm.
Or, of course, if a book is only available as an e-book.
Right, right.
But I'm pretty much a traditionalist in terms of, you know, I want the physical book. I still want the physical CD, in spite of how incredibly convenient downloading music is.
Right.
And in spite of the fact that it makes a little less of a difference, you know, if
mm-hmm.
you really look at it rationally.
Right.
But, you know, I want that thing in my hand. So.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I understand. I spent 12 years developing and growing the Stonewall National Museum. It started out as the Stonewall Library and Archives, and I've been around books. I've moved those 28,000 books four times, and you know I love the smell, the feel, the touch, everything about the book.
Yeah.
However, lately I don't know if it's laziness or just the convenience. Or whatever it is, we were going on vacation a few years ago on a very extended vacation, and I usually take about four or five books, and then I decided I was going to take five or six books, and I didn't really have the room, and I went out and bought a Kindle and put like 15 books on it, and it's been really hard for me to buy a book lately. Of course, I get a lot of books in the mail from publishers and things like that for this radio broadcast, but and I really... I'm starting to wean from the hard book, and I know I'm 60, almost 62, but I have a 35-year-old son from previous marriage to a woman, and he could not even think of, and he's a great reader, and he would not even think of buying a book. They have like no books in their home.
Huh.
I mean, it's
wow.
Except for some picture books. I know, and. You know, that's going to, unfortunately, I think that's something we're all going to have to deal with. And as I've spoken on this radio show before, I get 3 to 5 books or more a week to review or to ask to be on the show. And some of them are absolutely horrible. They're just the worst thing I've ever seen. I can't imagine, you know, because they're not edited. Anybody can put an ebook up on Amazon.com for no, you know, not much money or anything like that. And they send it to me as a PDF. And I start cringing. I'm not OCD, but I can't stand grammatical and typographic errors in books.
Yeah, if one is going to self-publish, you should have a really trustworthy person who you can pay,
right.
I think, to edit.
Right.
Because, yeah, some mistakes that really, and I don't mean that, you know, conceptual mistakes,
right.
But lots and lots of just like line editing errors.
Right. Exactly. And not only that, but then there also are conceptual mistakes that I have read books that I know no one has ever read except for the writer, that they've never had a writing group, they've never had an editor, they've never had a best friend, because if anyone had read, any other person but the person that had the thought in his mind had read this, they'd have gone, what the fuck are you talking about? So, you know, the democratization of publishing right now, where you can have a major publisher fail and a self-published person who has no publisher, who has a good social network, who has a great website, who is a good marketing person, who gets on the forums and the blogs, who has a decent book, can make a lot of money just e-publishing. The how much you make per book and how much a self-published ebook person is like four times or something. It's really profitable to do. So this is why there's so many people flying into it. Most of them, I think, are going to fail. I'm not sure where this is all going to shake out. Do you?
Yeah, I've followed to some degree some careers of people who started, I think, self-published. I should not be held to this with the names I'm going to mention, but it seems to me that the two I'm going to mention started with self-publishing and then were picked up,
uh-huh.
Or at least progressed from ebook to paper
uh-huh.
book, and that'll be Jay Bell and Ben Monopoly,
okay.
Two really wonderful young writers who, mm-hmm. you know, and again, I can't specify exactly what the journey's been because I don't have the information in front of
right.
me,
uh-huh.
but, you know, certainly someone who is persistent and markets and gets himself out there, as you know, both those guys did. They were really good with social media. can progress that way. Going back further, before the age of the e-book, Elin Harris, I believe, started selling his books out of the back of his car. And I think there have been some other cases in the gay publishing world. People move through all kinds of, it was easy to get your, relatively easy to get your hardback gay book published in the 90s. The economy was flush and everyone was, trying to open up that market. Then that kind of dried up, and yet the market that exists today, if there's not so much hardcover being published, it's still quite vibrant. Mm-hmm. I was very fortunate in finding a publisher back, Bob, just shortly. I'm sorry, my phone is beeping for some reason every few minutes. I don't think it means anything serious. I don't think there's a security threat. Back when Bob was written, I submitted it to a gay novel writing contest run by Suspect Thoughts Press. And it didn't win. I actually submitted two novels. Neither one won. Some months later, I ran into the writer, Jameson Currier, who I had met a couple of times before, and he told me that he had been a judge on that contest, and he said, I know you didn't win, but I just thought Bob the Book was absolutely wonderful and delightful, and if I were a publisher, I would publish it. And that and $2 gets you a ride on the subway. Well, lo and behold, he sent me some names of places I might send it, and I sent it to several of them, and they turned it down, and then I grew up and got a real responsible job and left all that behind. And then I get a message on Facebook in the spring of 2010, please let me know your email address. I want to send you a private message. And I thought, maybe he needs some contact information for someone who's a mutual friend or something. Well, lo and behold, what he says is, remember how I told you if I were a publisher, I'd publish Bob the Book? Well, I am, and I would like to.
Wow.
And a week later, I'm sitting in a coffee shop with him, figuring out cover design, schedule, where I should go on tour and where I should give readings. And and Bob is print on demand, which means it's roughly more or less printed as it's ordered, the great advantage of which is it never goes out of print. There's no decision about can we afford to print another thousand. It just prints as it's ordered. So Bob is kind of evergreen. And can be discovered and rediscovered, which you need with when it's a very small press and there's not really a lot of budget for publicity when your name is not known. It helps that it can be a book can be discovered over a very long period of time. Rather than here you've got this little window.
The
books don't
window.
Sell. We're not going to reprint them, and boom, that's it.
Right, the Barnes & Noble window. You have 2 weeks, and that's it.
So my window goes on and on, and I think that's also going to be important for my movie because I think that's going to be slowly discovered as well. Some of those stories may be re-anthologized. They may be used in classes and so
that's
forth. And slowly people will be curious about what is this short story volume that that initially, because the author was not known and the press was small, did not make this huge splash. But so that's been great. Jim Currier is a fabulous a publisher and editor and designer, and has terrific taste. Knows exactly when and how much to intervene and when not to. And so everything is very well taken care of, very responsibly taken care of. He is. I've had the great pleasure to be published alongside his terrific mix of both established authors like Felice DeCano, Walter Holland, Wesley Gibson, Charles Silverstein, and then new people like Michael Graves, Jeffrey Luscombe, and some others, and of course Jim himself. He started the press in order to publish his very delightful New Orleans novel, A Wolf at the Door, and then Bob was the second book from Chelsea Station Editions.
Great. Well, we have only like 1 minute left, which is amazing. Well, told you it's the fastest 30 minutes of your life.
It was.
To a new writer, what would you say to a new gay writer that walks up to you sheepishly and says, how do I write?
I'm not sure I would tell him this, but that's kind of not the right question. I would say that, this sounds ridiculously obvious, but you've got to finish something. Because you're young, you're unknown, you're not going to get anywhere on an outline or a half-written thing or anything like that. Someone may admire it, but they're not going to give you anything for it. So you have to finish something. You have to have a finished thing that you can talk about, that you can hand to someone,
right,
and you know, maybe gone over by that friend of yours. You've paid a few $100 to go over it.
Good.
Because okay. You want it kind of ready to go or close to ready to go.
And we are done for tonight. Is that great?
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Good night, and thank you, David. Take care.
Thank you, Nate.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.